Today is April 19th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original Personal Computer Radio Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King in the studio with me. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM, 99.5 on the radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, broadcasting atop the Empire State Building. We live stream the WBAI broadcast on WBAI.org. Our website is www.pcradioshow.org. Our constant reminder to listeners each week is backup, backup, and of course, backup. We end the show with that constant reminder. So let's start off tonight with a review of Acronis. Acronis is software for backup and recovery. Instead of reviewing software and commenting on its usage and functions, let's do something different tonight. It is common when evaluating software to review specifications, functions, and usage of a software package. From this, you can determine if it meets your processing needs. Generally, the given instructions for installation and implementation of software is applicable to all computer users. The exception to this is backup software. No two computer systems are identical in setup or with communications configuration with each other. The installed application is subjected to personal operating parameters. There is no set answer to the question, what do I backup? Even the same computer user with multiple systems does not have two systems exactly identical to each other. So instead of doing a spec review, let's first define what we expect from a backup utility or package. If at any point in time your system is lost, stolen, or damaged, but you have an immediate replica of the system in question to replace it, that would be the ideal backup. That would best define a total backup and recovery. These systems do exist for the military and, of course, certain financial institutions. For the home consumer, however, the ability to mirror all hardware, software, and communications is possible, but it's not cost-effective nor technically practical. A more practical approach is to replicate or save the data at a set point in time, such as on a daily basis, when the system is not in use. Install replacement equipment and communications when the situation needs it. Then restore the data onto the replacement equipment. At worst case is the loss of information for a day. The reference of data may also include the operating system and applications that are installed on the system. There are variations to this theme to minimize the time to do a periodic backup. You don't need to backup the hidden partition operating system each day. The partition information that came out of the factory does not change. It is needed, however, when you need to do a factory reset. It is used when there is a need to refresh the entire system to factory condition. It is not recommended that you free up this storage space on the hard disk drive by deleting these hidden partitions. When you need it, you want these partitions available and not have to rely on a damaged operating system to reload the necessary software. Neither is the operating system itself updated each day. With major software publishers, they update the software at most once a month. With smaller software publishers, it's only when necessary. The digital pictures and audio recordings you have are essentially static. They are seldom accessed. These files should be stored off the system and retrieved when it's necessary. Let's not forget retention of data. The saved information may be unreadable, The saved data may reside on media such as floppy diskettes or optical media that may have been corrupted by mishandling, or the data itself is subjected to degradation in storage. Thus, multiple generations of data is required. Having defined what is expected in the backup package, we find that Acronis addresses all the issues raised. They have extended the software to backup to the cloud. The same package license is for up to 5 systems. It crosses platforms, which also includes mobile smartphones. There are reference benchmarks or gold standards for a variety of personal computing products and services. Microsoft Office is the reference benchmark for office systems. Photoshop is synonymous with digital photograph editing. The Apple iPhone and arguably the Samsung Galaxy smartphones represent the best of breed in smartphones. Acronis is the best of breed when it comes to backup and recovery software. So what are the obstacles that inhibit computer users from backing up? The loss of valuable information itself should motivate everyone to back up, but only 15% of computer users do regular backups. Questions and or comments often asked are, where is the information located on the system to back up? The problem is owner data is not neatly located in one location. Another question is there a simple button or icon I can just hit or initiate to do a backup? One of the banes the users commonly face is the constant change in navigation and change in wording on software updates. A common excuse is, I don't have the time nor patience to do backups. I do have some suggestions for Acronis. On the Acronis website, make available predefined settings for different levels of backup that matches major operating system releases. Another is the availability of a utility that lets the user select their operating environment, and the utility itself proceeds to do the setup, inserting the parameters for the correct backup. When the mouse or pointer is placed over an icon, display the function of the icon. Acronis is a multi-language product. In the English version, avoid the geeky terms. Next week, our special on-air guest is Gaydar Magdanarov. He's the Vice President and General Manager of Acronis Online Business Systems. And I will have him on the air. And for listeners who have specific questions, hey, send them to me at pcradioshow.org, and I'll try to gather all of them together and ask them those questions. Joe?
You know, Hank, fascinating interview, review you just gave, and one that was useful to me personally. But at the end of the review, you pointed out, not in words, but in sound, that you're still not up to date. I mean, Hank, that was the Smith Corona portable you were typing on. What happened to your word processor?
Hey, you know, just because it's old doesn't mean it's not good. And as you know, what's old is new again. You know, I may just come up with a whole bunch of different sounds and run a contest, and let's see how many people can identify with the different sounds.
I wish you would. That sound that you just used is not too dissimilar from what Westbrook Pegler used in the 1940s, and he was a pretty hateful person, so I wouldn't like you to copy him. The question I have here is, you seem to be rather pleased that Acronis now lets you store and back up to the cloud.
That happens to be one of the options.
I think it's a very bad option.
Well, you know what? I think that we disagree philosophically. My attitude is backing up is, no matter how, you know, how you may disagree with it, is better than no backup.
A backup that you can't get access to when you need it is no backup. If you have it in the cloud and at the point that you need your backup, your machine is not online, or the cloud is not available for any variety of reasons, you don't have a backup. If you have it on a disk, a CD, or a DVD, or an alternate hard disk, or a S disk, you have it at your home or with your next-door neighbors. You have it in your bank vault. You have it. It's yours. If it's in the cloud, you're counting on somebody you don't even know, you've never met, and you've never talked with, somebody out there holding on and giving it to you when you need it. That's not a backup. That's a gamble.
No, actually, in the case of Acronis, what they're saying is if you prefer to have a cloud backup, when you purchase the package, for the first year, they have, I forgot the number, but it's a very high number of gigabytes available for backing up. But you don't have to use it. You could say, listen, I'm going to continue to use my external storage device.
I think it's lovely that they have it, and it behooves you to tell people how dangerous it is to use it.
Well, you know what? We have Gator on next week, and you may want to raise that issue with him and how he feels about it. But I think there are a couple of things that are inevitable that whether you like it or not, it's going to happen. One is, you know, wireless transmission is going to be the norm as opposed to hardwire transmission. The other is cloud storage. It's a big thing now. I mean, everyone's going to the cloud. They're even doing banking through the cloud. So
they do all of that, and I want everybody to remember that whatever you put in the cloud, the government has access to without your knowledge or permission. But that's another story. One thing you did mention to me, and I don't know if it came out clearly during your interview, is when you buy the Acronis, you can use it on virtually any machine you have, whether it's an Apple, a Mac OS, an iOS, an Android, a Windows. I'm assuming that they also have a version for Linux or Unix. I'm not sure about that.
I don't believe so, but you can, because if you are, it's possible to run Windows software on a Linux machine. So
in that sense, you can. So the fact that it says if you buy one package, you can use it on five machines, my first thought was...
Can be all different.
Well, my first thought was that's a waste of time because I only have one Windows machine. And then you pointed out to me, yeah, but I have a tablet that's an Android tablet, and I have an iPhone, and I also have a Samsung phone, and I could use it on all of those. And right there, it became from a reasonably priced package to a very economical package, a real bargain, if it works.
It does work. I've been using it. And there are a couple other things that that it also has. It can do silent backup. In other words, normally most people say at the end of day when I'm doing nothing, I stop what I'm doing and then I start backing up. With Acronis, you could say back up when I'm not doing anything. And the other option it has is that if you're backing up at night and you want to say it's nice to back up, but then my system is left on, no, you can. You also have the option where after you back up, it turns off the machine automatically, too.
Well, that's good. Can I select which files I want backed up, or do I have to go with their predetermined package?
Well, you can do a total backup, which is an image backup. You can do a selective backup of whatever choice of files you want or subdirectories, and you can also recover selective files from a total image backup. So
you're saying if I take an image of my hard disk, that is a picture of my hard disk, and I only want to recover the
one
letter
file
that I sent you 3 months ago, that one letter, I can find that one file on that whole image and just download that?
Correct.
Wow, that I never used to be able to. I used to make images once a month just to have a total up-to-date thing, but I would back up individual files on a daily basis. I didn't realize you could do it that way.
Well, one of the things that most people who've been listening to us for over 30 years know is that you and I are, in a sense, good friends, but we're 180 degrees from each other in some of the things we do. And one of the things I always once in a while embarrass you is, Joe, have you backed up?
And my answer to that is, usually no, but occasionally it is, well, some things. I very rarely back up everything. When I have a hidden partition on my computer, which in essence is a backup of the operating system, the original operating.
But I also back that up, too, because if the hard disk crashes and you can't access the information on it, where do you go?
I go to you.
By the way, the other reason why you should save the hidden partition is that you want to move to a different drive. So in other words, you want to move the whole thing from a hard drive to a solid-state drive or higher capacity drive. So that's one reason why you want to save that hidden partition. But I also, as I said when reviewing the product, is that don't remove the hidden partition because you need more space. It's because how do you get that hidden partition to reset it to factory condition if you can't get it onto the drive itself?
Well, the other reason to back up that hidden partition is generally, or not generally, but very possibly the reason you want to use that hidden partition is to restore the operating system after you've had a crash on the very disk that contains that hidden partition.
You know, it's so important that we get people to be conscious of backing up. I remember back in the 1970s, it took a long time for people to have it in their consciousness to fasten a seatbelt when they're in a car. And hopefully, maybe we're never going to get 100% of the people to back up, but that 15% that is a survey done by Microsoft is a very low number. I mean, I like to see that double in the next year or two at the very minimum. And go ahead.
I really disagree with you. I really disagree with you. I don't want to see that number double. I want to see that number automated. When I buy a computer that uses a Microsoft operating system, I want it to do the backing up of whatever is necessary automatically without me.
You can do that with Acronis. I don't know if you're aware of that, but you can. Like one of the things that that Microsoft did, okay, on their Office system is that you are editing a document, and instead of waiting for you to save the document, every interval of time, it saves the document itself, so you can go back to whatever level you want. And Acronis basically says, hey, you could set it for a day, a week, whatever period you want, and they can do it silently in the background so that it'll start when they can do it. They'll stop what they're doing when you need the machine. That's the way it should be done.
Many years ago, Microsoft decided to put in automatically a signal that a file had content changed. They called it the archive bit.
No, it was the attribute bit.
Well, in the attribute bit, yes, the archive was set. Now, if they now in their operating system kept a record of all of those attribute bits where the archive new material is in, and then every night at a given time that you could set, it just backs it up if it's needed.
Well, in the Acronis backup, they can have differential backup. They can have incremental backup. There are different kinds of backups. In other words, backup only that which changed, or backup that which was been added to them.
That's what I'm talking about in the operating system, and what you're telling me is that Acronis can do that for me without a change in the operating system.
Now, by the way, I just want to tell you that there are many backup packages that does a lot of these things, but to have it all in under one roof is very rare with many of the backup packages. And Acronis does have it, and I'm not shilling for them, but I just want to say that they are the gold standard that people measure their products by in terms of doing a backup and recovery. Like, you know, people use the Microsoft Office system as a standard for measuring the quality and functions of an Office system.
That they do. I have reviewed over the last 30-odd years probably 100 different backup programs, and I have never reviewed one that I've liked. Now I've now got to officially look at this one because you've answered three or four questions that made me not like other packages, and you've said they're here. I won't promise to have it done by next week when you're interviewing Acronis, but in the very near future, I will have reviewed it myself, and I'll tell you what I think of it.
Again, I repeat, if you have specific questions that you'd like to have Acronis address, send us email to make it Hank at pcradioshow.org, and I will combine all the questions I have, and we'll raise it next week.
Let me give that address again, because people are not used to this. This is a new address for them. Hank, H-A-N-K, at pcradioshow.org.
Okay, good. Joe, you know, there's a lot of confusion in this area, and one of the things that we talked about is sometimes you read a headline and you say, wait a minute, what are they talking about, okay? One of the headlines you and I was reviewing is that they said that support for original version of Windows 10 ends May 9th. And you say,
that made no sense. I just installed Windows 10 in one machine, and I just bought a machine with Windows 10. And how are they not going to support it? That's the silliest thing I ever heard.
Well, what happened was that they had a Windows Insider program where they invited a lot of people to do beta testing. And when Windows was officially released and the build number was 1511, which means it was released in November of 2015, they continued to make patches available for the beta versions. And they've said that the final beta version, which was released in 2015 in the month of May, they're going to stop providing support or patches to it ending May 9th. That makes sense. But the way this
is... That's not what the headline said, Hank.
Well, I'm telling you what Microsoft said, which is correct. But the headlines of some of these people gave a scare to people saying, wait a minute, it says the original version of Windows 10 support ends. No. The original version, official version release, was build number 1511, or it was November of 2015. They're talking about the last beta, and I realize that's very confusing, and I just wish that journalists would not try to put a scare tactic to get attention.
It's not the scare tactic.
It is a scare tactic.
I think I'm putting words into their mouths, but I think they just didn't understand what Microsoft's release said.
Well, okay, if you say that. Hey, you know what was announced that I think it's a very fascinating and interesting? You know, the Raspberry Pi has a certain following. It's almost cult-like. And they have some very interesting software. One is called the Pixel OS. It's a version of Linux people who are doing development work for the Raspberry Pi can play with. And if you're interested in playing with it, well, if you want to get started, you buy the Raspberry Pi. That's a $35 item. But you find that, wait a minute, you got to buy an SD card to put the operating system on. That's another $4, $5. You need a power supply. Oh, that's a $6, $7 item. You need a cheap keyboard or good keyboard. Let's say cheap keyboard is $6, $7, and that's really cheap. And by the time you're done, you're adding a whole lot of stuff to it. But you still really want to know about this Raspberry Pi Pixel OS, because you may like to be able to do some experimentation with it. The operating system itself will now be available, or soon available, to run under Windows as well as OS X. That's a big story.
And what will that cost?
Nothing. Nothing at all. And you can actually download the software. And it's a Pixel OS, or that's how they call it. And you can download it, and you can run it off a stick, in other words, off a USB drive, or you can actually load it onto your hard drive and install it and run it. And by the way, this is very much like any kind of a Linux distribution that you're downloading to test.
Have you had an opportunity to play with it yourself?
No, I just haven't had time. I've been playing with, in terms of Linux, I've been playing with other Linux distributions. You know, in terms of Linux distributions that can run on Intel hardware, okay, because there's also Linux distributions that run under ARM architecture, there's something like 340 different Linux versions available, and that is the downfall of Linux. In other words, it's nice to have many varieties of Linux, but there's so many that none of it gains traction in the public. None at all.
Well, is there a place that you go to online, not only where you can download the software, but you can find out about it, whether or not you'd really like to download it?
I go to distrowatch.com, DistroWatch.com, and that you can do. Hey, Joe, I want to make note in passing that a true pioneer in the field of computing passed away this weekend, and he's really an unsung hero because very few people have heard of him, although I have back in the 60s. I knew who he was. His name is Robert Taylor, and, of course, there's a Robert Taylor, the actor, but this he's not the actor. And, Joe, why don't you tell the people what he is noted for, because most people don't realize he is responsible for what we call the Internet today.
Well, when he was in working for the government, he was working for the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, and that got itself with a nickname of DARPA, and he dropped the D, and he invented... I don't think invented is the right word. I'm not sure what the right word is.
He created ARPANET.
He created a thing called ARPANET. And as ARPANET grew and developed, originally it simply was there to connect the, I think it was 6 supercomputer centers in the United States. And I think it expanded out from there. And it came under a new name that we all heard of, Internet.
Well, what happened, Joe, was that in the 60s, and I know what it was like because I went through the same thing he went through, is that there were so many different networks, networks to universities, network to a defense center. And what happens is that you had one terminal to go to each of the different networks. And we were saying, wouldn't it be nice if I just had this one terminal go to any selected network I want instead of having a dedicated terminal to a network. And before you know it, you have so many terminals around that you lose sight of it.
Exactly. His concept of the Internet would be a vast grid of different devices that were all interconnected. But it was more than that. If any one of those devices was destroyed, the network would still work. It would automatically search around for a different link to call it what it was. And eventually, even while he was here, I mean, he died at age 85. Well, was it last week, Hank?
Last week, right.
And there are probably close to 1 billion points on the Internet at this point, or maybe even more than 1 billion. And if any one of those sites goes down, even a backbone site, it won't affect anything. The Internet will still continue thanks to work by Robert Taylor and his colleagues.
Yeah, and by the way, what most people don't realize is that when he left the service in 1970, he went to work for Xerox, and he was in charge of Xerox PARC Network, and one of his projects was Ethernet. So... he's really a truly one of the pioneers and unsung hero in the area of communications, and we make note, and unfortunately things happen so quickly, so many things happen that we tend to forget who did what and so on, and every once in a while we have to take the time out to remind people what has been done, and
the whole thing probably did start with Alexander Graham Bell. But without people like Robert Taylor, it would still have been one telephone calling another.
Yes. Hey, Joe, let me switch over. We have a couple of feature segments that our contributors have and our associates have come up with, and it's quite interesting. Alfred Poor has one on wearable tech that has to do with Parkinson, and for those, that's really a major disease that people don't understand what it is. And then we have Joe Rejeski with another simple tech tip for people who are busy. And we have a home automation segment from Marty Winston. So let's get to that and just remind everyone that next week we will have Acronis on the air to, Oh, we'll ask him whatever questions you want us to ask him, okay? So let's get to these feature segments.
They want, if the audience, anybody in the audience wants you to ask a specific question, they should write to you, hank@pcradioshow.org, and you'll be happy to pass the question on to our guest.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. Last month I traveled to Australia, which was a very long airplane flight, I can tell you. And I wouldn't have made it without a pair of noise-canceling earphones. These are modern technology miracles. And basically what they do is they create a sound that cancels out many of the sounds, especially the lower frequency sounds of the airplane rumble, and it creates a much quieter environment and helps you arrive more relaxed and better rested. But I don't want to talk about noise canceling headphones in this segment. My real point is to talk about patients with Parkinson's disease. It's a neurological disease that affects muscle control, and one of the typical symptoms is hand tremors. And it's so bad that many patients can't feed themselves, they can't drink from a glass, they can't dress themselves, and it's a real problem. There are a number of drugs and other kinds of treatments that people have tried to help address these tremors and reduce the problem. The cool thing is that wouldn't it be interesting if you could create a solution that was like those noise-canceling headsets? Every time your tremor caused your hand to move in one direction, if you could cancel that movement out with an opposite movement, you could steady the hand. And that's exactly the concept behind a product that we've covered in the past called Liftwear. It's actually a spoon with a motor in it, and it senses the movement of the hand, and it pivots the spoon to help it stay level when the hand is shaking. So it's acting sort of like a noise-canceling headset. It cancels the motion of the shaking hand. Again, that's from a company called Liftwear. But that only solves one problem. It only solves the problem of what happens when you're trying to feed yourself. What about the drinking from a glass or getting dressed or any other kinds of activities where you need a steady hand? Well, there's a group from Pakistan who created a system that they call TAME, which stands for Tremor Acquisition and Minimization. It's really very clever. It's a smart sleeve, a smart garment that you would pull onto your arm, and it's battery powered. And one of the components is a motion sensor. So it has an inertial sensor and determines how your hand is moving, your forearm actually. It sends this data to a controller pack. It sends electrical pulses to two electrodes that are mounted up against your forearm. When these electrodes fire, they cause the muscles to contract. So what's possible is to sense the movement of the hand and then send a countermeasure impulse to the muscles in the forearm to move the hand in the opposite direction. And the result is really astounding. It can help a patient hold their hand much steadier. Very cool thing about it is apparently the controller is able to determine the difference between an inadvertent tremor motion and an intentional motion where you're actually trying to move your hand. This concept has won a number of awards, including most recently a 2017 design challenge called Innovating Aging in Place, which is sponsored by the Stanford Center on Longevity. If this product can be brought to market at a reasonable price, it could provide relief for Parkinson's disease patients as well as other patients who have similar tremors. On a more mundane topic, most of us have at least one or two bad habits that we'd like to get out of, whether it's biting our nails or spending too much time on Facebook or eating too many snacks, whatever it is. It turns out that breaking bad habits can be very, very difficult. The behavior can be very hard to change. Well, there's a product out called Pavlok from a company called Behavior Technology Group. What they've done is created a system that actually uses aversion therapy. It gives you a negative stimulus when you perform a behavior that you're trying to get rid of. What it is a tiny little module that is wireless and works with a smartphone application, either Android or iOS. When it's triggered, it can either vibrate and give you an alert, or it can deliver a mild shock. Now, that may seem a little harsh, but it's a very effective way to train yourself to not do the behavior that you're trying to eliminate. The cool thing about the application is that it links to IFTTT. This is an online open source service called If This Then That, and you can create your own scripts that will activate the device, either to send an alert or, if you want, to send a shock. So if you have a smart refrigerator, you could program it that you get a shock every time you open the door, or if you open the door within 20 minutes of the last time you opened it. Or maybe you could set up a script that sets a time limit for how long you're on Facebook, or if you go on Facebook within certain hours. Basically, there's all kinds of different triggers and scripts that you could write for this. And you can manually trigger the shock or negative response if you catch yourself doing something that you want to stop. So if you'd like to get rid of that bad habit, the Pavlok, P-A-V-L-O-K, may be the device that can finally give you the willpower and the counter conditioning that it takes to break that habit. Epilepsy is a serious neurological disease. It affects more than 50 million people worldwide. One of the common symptoms of epilepsy are the seizures. And some can be very mild and just an irritation, but some of them can be very serious, risking injury or even life for the patient or for people around them, if somebody should have a seizure while they're driving, for example. The problem is that scientists apparently don't have a clear understanding about how these seizures work. Some researchers believe that they create ripples of brain waves in the brain cause the seizures. Researchers at Carnegie Mellon and University of California, Berkeley, have done some research on how to address seizures and cause them to stop before they start. According to these scientists, they view the seizures as, quote, a synchronized collective of waves propagating across cortical regions. In other words, these waves of activity pass through the brain and disrupt what the brain is supposed to be doing, causing the seizures. They have run a simulation and figured out that by randomly stimulating the brain, they can disrupt the progression of those waves and actually cause those waves to break up and stop altogether. Unlike some of the other treatments, you don't need to know exactly where the seizure is starting from. All you need to know is that these waves are occurring in the brain, and by sending these random stimuli, you can break up those waves and halt the seizure. The simulations are so effective that they believe that this is an approach that can work with human patients. They could create a hat that would both have sensors and ultrasonic transducers. The sensors could monitor brain activity, and when they detect these waves of activity that signal a seizure, the ultrasonic transducers could then bathe the brain with this random stimuli and break up the waves of activity and halt the seizure before it even gets started. If this approach proves to be effective, this could result in a non-invasive, non-chemical solution to epileptic seizures and could benefit millions of patients worldwide. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred.
Mishaps when completing forms on websites? Well, partner, they're going to be a thing of the past. Hey, it's time for simple computer tips for busy people like you. I'm Joe Rejeski, author of the soon-to-be-released book, Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Have you ever filled out a form on a web page, hit the submit button, and then something happened that required you to type everything all over again? Maybe the web browser froze or the page refreshed without saving your entry. It happens from time to time, so to avoid retyping the text, there are a few things you should be doing before pressing that submit button. First, to avoid entering the same text on websites, text like your name, address, email address, and phone number, use a password manager. Yeah, last week I discussed using a password manager, and one feature that is awesome is the ability to save your personal information so you don't need to enter that stuff every single time. You just enter your identity in your password manager, and then the password manager automatically fills in all your personal information with a click of a button, so you don't need to type it. But this week, I want to mention something else that will save you a lot of time when completing web forms. There are times you need to type a few sentences or paragraphs of text. Maybe you are typing your opinion on a social media website. Well, whenever you need to enter a few sentences or more into a web form, before clicking the submit button, what I do is I place my cursor in the area with the sentences, and then I press Control A and then Control C. Why do you do that, Joe? Glad you asked. Control A selects all, hence the A, and Control C copies the text. If there's an issue and I need to type those sentences again, I can just paste what I copied instead of retyping everything. It's like an insurance policy. All you need to do is hold the control key, press the letter A, let go of the letter A, and then while still holding the control key, then press the letter C. It takes a second. If you copy the text you typed and you click the submit button and something goes wrong, you can just paste that text back into the box. You don't need to type it all over again. As a bonus, Control A and Control C work in most applications. Control A selects everything, such as all the text in an email, a word processing program, or a spreadsheet application. And Control C is a keyboard shortcut for copying selected text or images. Here's another tip for quickly completing forms on websites. You don't need to scroll through all the entries in a drop-down list to find your selection. Just press the first letter of the word you are looking for, the word you would like to jump to. For example, let's say you need to select from a drop-down list the state you live in. To quickly find the state New York from a drop-down list of states, just click the drop-down list and then press the letter N, like New York, to jump to all the states that start with the letter N. Then you can either use the mouse to move down a little bit or press the down arrow a few more times to find New York. This tip works with all drop-down lists, including drop-down lists in applications. There you go. That's this week's Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Try these tips now and you'll never forget them. Did you like this tip or do you have a computer tip for me? Well, let me know. Just visit www.simplecomputertipsforbusypeople.com. I'm Joe Rejeski. Over and out.
Thank you, Joe. Public service announcements. The Princeton PCs Users Group will have a presentation on Create Your Website or Blog Site, and the meeting date is April the 25th at 7 p.m., and it's held at the Community Room of the Princeton Public Library in Princeton, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on Scary Alphabet Soup. They meet on Thursday, April the 27th. Starting meeting time is 6:45 p.m., Middletown Township Public Library, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on drones and radio control technology. Tuesday, May 2nd at 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Computer Learning Center of Ewing will have a presentation on how to buy a personal computer, the gamut from smartphone to desktop. Tuesday, May 2nd, 2 p.m., Community Room, 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The Westchester PCs Users Group will have a presentation on Eat Well, Think Clearly, and Live Fully. May 4th, 7 p.m. is the meeting time at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their main meeting on Friday, the May 5th, 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartow Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Rockland PC Users Group will have their meeting on Tuesday, May 9th, 7:15 p.m. at the Rassel Room on the Palisades Mall, fourth floor, West Nyack, New York. All these meetings are open to the public. They hope that you're going to be able to make some of them.
There's been so much talk about walls in the news lately, I thought I probably ought to talk about walls, not the same kind, and really, this is about what the walls are going to be in our 40-year house. And I do absolutely invite you to take a look at 40yearhouse.com. Our house will have something called SIP. Get into that in a second. What do we know about building houses with different materials? Well, we have the three little pigs. The first little pig built his house of straw. Second little pig built his house of sticks. Third little pig built his house of bricks. We'll skip the straw for now, and we'll come to the bricks later. Let's talk about sticks. Sticks happens to be a jargon term for a way of constructing a house, the way most houses are constructed, probably the one you're in right now, many apartments done the same way, using studs, nominally, and only nominally, a 2x4. It may be a 2x6, a 2x8. The 2's not really a 2. The 4 or the 6 or the 8 are not really 4s or 6 or 8s. They're a way to refer to standard sizes of these upright members of walls. If you see it, you know, it's like a grid. You've seen homes go up and you've got these sticks and you see right through them. I want you to think about the stud itself. It's a piece of lumber. And a piece of lumber is not a perfect insulator. Heat can travel from one side of the board to the other, like trucks can travel from one side of a bridge to another. And in fact, it's called thermal bridging. Thermal bridging is one reason that stud construction is not the most efficient way, in terms of temperature loss, to build a house. Normally, the studs go up. Between them, there is some kind of insulation, often a fuzzy, fibrous foam on a roll. Sometimes it gets blown in, sometimes it's just rolled out. Then there is an outer cladding, a piece of flat board, often in engineered lumber, sometimes stuff like plywood, that gets nailed onto the stud on the outside and something on the inside. Another piece of cladding maybe just the interior wallboard. Okay, so what do you have? You've got this set of thermal bridges in a grid with a fuzzy stuff in there with air gaps, so that if there is any air hole in the outside construction, and since it's made of panels, there could be, you're going to let air through. Bottom line is you might have an R13 rating, that's a way of rating insulation, for the stuff on a roll that you put in the wall, but the net effect on the wall is more likely to get measured, and I've seen measurements of this, R4. You've lost a lot of insulation there. Does that matter? What difference does it make? Well, it makes difference short term in more energy costs. It makes a difference up front in needing to buy a higher capacity heating air conditioning system. It makes a difference out back because you're running that heating air conditioning or heat pump system harder. It means that you're going to be needing to replace it earlier. But what alternative do you have? The best alternative out there today is a thing called a SIP wall, S-I-P. That's short for, we like our three-letter acronyms, that's short for Structural Insulated Panel, SIP, Structural Insulated Panel. And if the stick wall was inspired by the three little pigs, it isn't. The difference is that a SIP wall is really kind of a big-scale Oreo cookie. The outside is OSB, oriented strand board, and engineered lumber. And you thought engineering was just for your electronics, right? Engineering's all over the house. These big engineered panels are made from chunks of wood in a binder laid against each other. They are stronger than plywood. They can be made bigger than plywood. You don't have to have a tree that size to get an OSB board that size. That's one of the benefits of it. So you've got OSB board on the outside and the inside of a sandwich. And inside, you've got a fairly thick layer of insulating foam, usually an expanded polystyrene foam. Now, with solid walls on the inside and outside, there's nowhere for air to get through, even if it could. And if it did get through, it would just hit that block of foam and have nowhere to go. So that is the first part of why this works better. The other part, as you might guess, is that there's no thermal bridging. There is no piece of wood that has a face both on the inside and the outside of the wall. So with no thermal bridging, with no way for air to deal with inside the wall, you're dealing with a wall that might have a native rating of 17 to 19, but it gets better. There's a new form of insulation for SIP walls. It's a secret formula that originated at BASF. It's in a foam called Neopor, N-E-O-P-O-R. And the secret recipe has graphite in it, which helps it be an even better insulator, 11 to 12% better insulator as rated out in the field. Neopor, and I guess similar foams, if they're out there, with graphite in them, don't look white like the standard EPS foams. They look gray, and that's a good way to tell. With a Neopor wall, the effective value of the entire SIP wall turns out to be close to R26. Oh, brother, is that a good thing? Yeah, you're going to spend a little bit more up front. Well, at least on the wall part. You might get away with having an HVAC or heat pump system that's downsized by up to 50%. So you're going to save money on that. On your monthly energy bills, those are likely to drop by as much as 50%. So there's some ongoing savings. But the really big factor happens downstream because you're not needing to drive the heating, cooling system, the heat pump system, the HVAC system. You're not needing to drive it nearly as hard. So it's not going to need repair or replacement nearly so soon. And the more you delay those major costs, the more you're happy that you put a SIP in to begin with. Something you might also care about, and this is not a cash thing in your pocket, but it's good for the rest of us. When you build a home with a SIP wall, it uses less forest. You have to harvest less forest than you do for a standard stud wall. Those sticks down more trees than SIPs. So if you're doing a new construction or if you're looking at major renovations that involve the exterior walls, absolutely investigate structural insulated panels. I did promise to talk about bricks, didn't I? Well, let's do that. Bricks outside a house or lath boards or shingles or stone are not always what they seem. Those are often siding elements. Brilliantly done, some of them, but the bricks or stone, for example, may be made out of formed concrete. Some of the wall board may be an advanced polystyrene or something as simple as vinyl. The point about bricks is they aren't bricks. And even if they were bricks, having a SIP wall means that you don't have to worry about what it is. You're already insulated. You're already protected. It's there to look nice. So, have you learned enough about SIPs? They're the very best choice we've found for building a new house. And that means when it comes to needing to spend money later, you won't find yourself quite so much up against the wall. Back to you.
Thank you, Marty. The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing. And back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.